folks, and welcome or welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast was brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis, a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for the past 2 decades, 8 years of which he's been actively buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in the city on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So his company has a dedicated loan officer in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions. So you're probably already aware that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or if you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on emil.gorgis, that's emil.gorgis, emil.gorgis@tokyorealty.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so for today's episode, we're back with our JREP, Japan Real Estate Experts panel, and this time we've got Matt in attendance as well, which is becoming harder and harder these days as he's getting busier and busier. So we've pounced on the opportunity to talk to him about Akiya, or vacant slash abandoned homes in the Japanese countryside, which is his specialty. He's got some stories about monkeys that he shared with us, and we also get more serious and answer some questions from listeners, mainly regarding flipping properties as a business strategy, long and short-term rentals out in the countryside. Are these all possible? Are they profitable? Renovation projects, and whether it's possible to have them financed. Short-term stay regulations and compliance, marketing these countryside properties as businesses and building them up as tourist destinations, and then some more general property market related tidbits such as loan approvals and loan refusals, which can be based on non-standard renovations done to structures, raising, reducing, and maintaining rents and the various complexities and legal aspects of these practices, and much, much more. So really nice, long conversation with the usual suspects. Hope you'll enjoy it, and I'll see you again on the other side. Awesome, and we're back.
Yay.
Hello, everyone.
In full form today, too.
I feel like it's been a while, since maybe like 2 weeks or something.
You missed last week. Yeah. We were on form last week.
Well, yeah, for like I checked out.
I loved last week, actually. It was so casual.
It was. I think most weeks are. But I think the week before as well, we cancelled it.
Yep.
That's right.
So it's been 3 weeks.
Wow.
It was a holiday. We're just not aware of them usually until they actually happen. But
that's, yes, the joys of being a being self-employed. You don't sort of know when to go to work and when not to go to work.
Yeah. So Am I working?
Yeah. Am I working? Yeah. Yeah.
So before we get into it and do the intros and all that, we need to hear about the monkeys, Matt.
Yes, we have questions about the monkeys.
What about them?
But what the whole story, run it all by us. Where are you? What happened? Why are there monkeys in the house?
Oh, okay. So yeah, this is interesting. It's strange. So Yugawara is like, so there's Odawara, and then after that there's, what is it, Hayakawa, Nebukawa, Manazuru, Yugawara, and Atami. And I don't know why, but only Yugawara basically has monkeys. They're very, very, very focused on the Yugawara area. They're not really in Atami. They're kind of in Manazuru a little bit. I hear rumor of them in Odawara, but for the most part, they're just like totally focused on Yugawara, which I don't understand. But yes, there's a lot of monkeys. In fact, there was a pack yesterday that we were drinking beer and watching. For our evening entertainment.
So you're drinking beer with?
Almost. Almost. But yeah, there's a lot of stories about the monkeys, but I think the one that maybe you're referencing is something that I mentioned on Twitter.
Yes.
Okay, so there's the place that I live, which was an Akiya, but is no longer an Akiya, obviously. But the one next door is one of the like serious cases of like, okay, that's a lost cause. Don't even touch. I mean, there's like a forest growing on the third floor balcony and all this stuff. So last year, the monkeys haven't really been around this year, or maybe I'm just getting impatient, but I kind of noticed a conspicuous lack of monkey business. but I noticed last year that the place next to me, the really hardcore, I would call it a haikyo. I wouldn't even call it akiya. It's like a just ruined building. I noticed last year that they had busted open the roof and were climbing in and out. And so I'm assuming that like, oh, okay, they set up shop there a bit. But then like, I think what I was talking about on Twitter was like, well, apparently if like 40% of Yugawara is vacant buildings. And so if they broke in and started living in the Akiya next to me, who's to say that they haven't also done this elsewhere, which makes me wonder, is there like a hidden underground network of like monkeys?
It's like a whole Walking Dead scenario there.
Yeah.
There's made movies about this. We should be concerned.
Do they redecorate? That's what I want to know. Did they redecorate? Do they like...
I'm not sure if you call it decoration, but
they fling poop on the walls and stuff, right? They like,
yeah, that's what I was thinking. Well, and apparently one of the troops of monkeys yesterday got really like rather like overly confident, and so one of my friends has you know, like the the little shrine or whatever in your house, and that's got the little things of sugar and salt. And so apparently the other day, like Mr. Monkey just decided I want that sugar and just went right through the window over to the shrine thing in their house as they're sitting there and just grabbed the sugar and left. So there's a lot of this year's monkey report is I believe it's begun. Have started, have commenced.
And the other question I have is, like, if they take your sandals, are they walking around wearing them?
No, unfortunately. Unfortunately, that I would welcome that as a development. No, they just throw them everywhere, and then they, you know, jump up and down on your roof at like 3 a.m. Like this morning, they were really active, and it's very, they're a nuisance. But they're protected by the national government. There's some kind of you know, symbol or whatnot, and so you can't kill them. You can throw firecrackers at them. The Yugawara municipal, yeah, I actually keep meaning to do an interview with the guy who runs the municipally sanctioned, I think it's even like a job, like there might even be money involved, there's this troop of, I don't know, like five, I'm pretty sure all male retirees. They've got the official, you know, Yugawara Monkey Patrol.
Monkey uniform. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
They have a mascot.
And their whole thing is they run around, they, you know, they get like a monkey call, right? Saying like, yeah, the monkeys are here. And they get into their car and they drive over there and they're loaded with a bunch of firecrackers that they just throw at the monkeys. And I've seen this, I'm not making this up. I've seen them at work. They're literally every day out there protecting the good people of Yugawara from, you know, monkey maniacal.
It's not a joke. I saved one of my, when we were living in more suburban area of the city, one of my neighbors was not attacked, but like she was just this old little obachan living on her own. And she was like hunkered down inside the house. And this monkey was banging on the bars trying to get in.
Yep.
We scared him off, but he didn't look too scared. He just like climbed to the top of the hill and just sat there and looked at us. It's not like you yell at them and they go away.
No, no, no. They're totally used to all of it. Like you just watch. In fact, this thing. So I remember watching some of the gentlemen with the firecrackers.
The order of the monkey.
Yeah, and the monkeys are just like hanging out on top of the roof being like, really, guys? Like, I don't think so. Like, you're not scared enough. We'll just break more things.
You need bigger firecrackers.
Yeah.
And if you want to experience some of the wonderful adventures of Japan's countryside, this is the perfect segue to introductions. Matt, what do you actually do?
Yeah, I'm one half of Akiya and Inaka, which is a real estate consultancy. that specializes in the location, vetting, and acquisition of all of these wonderful abandoned and otherwise vacant houses across mostly rural Japan. They exist in the cities, but they're usually way worse in the city. And besides, like, why would you want to be in the city when you can have all of this monkey fun?
Vacant aside from monkeys occasionally.
Yeah, I'm like, I like the story of the monkeys stealing someone else's stuff.
Yeah.
I just don't want any monkeys in my life. I have to deal with
they're a pain. I'm not a fan. I was a fan for like a month or two, and then I just realized that they're just stealing and breaking stuff. I can't do anything about it.
Yeah, so we're going to go into focus on you in a bit, Matt, because I got a really big three-part question for you today. Oh, but first, let's introduce the rest of you guys. Tracy?
Multi-part questions.
So yeah, I'm Tracy. I am the short-term rental minpaku expert on this panel. So I've been doing short-term rentals in Tokyo for the last decade, and I do my own. And also I help other people set up their rentals and maximize their profits. That's me.
And Emil.
Hey, my name's Emil. I'm a real estate agent here in Tokyo. I help foreigners buy, mainly local residents, but usually a foreigner, foreign or mixed families, buy the family home in Tokyo. And we also have, we also act as a bit of a mortgage broker. Because we're a licensed real estate agency, we have banks and loan offices that we liaise with directly. So we also can answer any question and organize your typical Japanese home loan financing, you know, 100% financing, you know, 0.5, 0.6% interest rates. So, yeah, that's what we do. And Ziv, over to you, mate.
Yeah, and I'm Ziv, and also been at it for about a decade. My wife and I run a real estate advisory and proxy or buyer's advocacy company, and we help foreigners, whether they're in Japan or out of Japan. Most of them are actually out of Japan in most cases, who either are not physically here to handle the purchase or management or sale process, or are here but are just for one reason or another not inclined or not able to do it on their own. So we provide them full representation on their behalf. Investment properties, holiday homes, land for development, commercial properties, you name it. And we are the Japan Real Estate Experts Panel, or JREP for short. And I'm going to dive right into this really, really big question. Just let me bring it up so that I'm not misrepresenting the original poster. So Matt, this is, I mean, the first part of the question is definitely to you, but I think on the other two parts, we can all jump in. Okay. So this guy, he's living here in Fukuoka, and what he's asking is, why do we never hear of people buying up the old Akiya Bank properties and flipping them to foreigners or renting them out to all of the immigrant workers who are coming over? It seems like an obvious market to him, but he's assuming that there might be some regulations preventing these investments. Anything of that sort?
Yeah, it's not that complicated of an answer. I mean, we've touched on a big part of it previously, which is that you within 5 years of purchase, you're looking at just ridiculous capital gains taxes. And so the whole idea,
especially if you brought it up from zero to actually being worth something, right?
Yeah, right. So the whole idea of flipping in the sense that I think is generally understood is at best a non-starter, right? Unless you're very masochistic and just want to hemorrhage cash for some reason. There's no real good reason to do it within that time frame. One thing that...
But that's individually too, right? Like if you actually purchase it as a company, there's no capital gains tax.
Right. And there's... I actually need to check in on that. But generally speaking, we're working with individuals who are looking at getting these things up to speed in that sense. So yeah, that's a little bit of a blank spot. But generally speaking, it's just a very difficult way to go about doing it. But what we've... I wouldn't even call it a campaign. It's more of just like an idea that's still in the works, is that, you know, if you just look at it in a different manner with a different time frame, though, and add a few things, and in fact, this is where Tracy would end up coming in. You know, you could technically like flip it. It just looks different, right? And what that would look like, what we envision anyway, is, well, you know, get the place, invest in it, bring it up to working speed, get a minpaku license, rent it out for 5 or 6 years or something like that, get past that time frame. And from there, then you can reasonably start imagining that you can indeed sell the property at a profit, of course,
or even just living it yourself for like 5 years.
Exactly, haven't paid itself off and things like this. So the it's doable. You just kind of have to reconfigure what it is, I think. And then there's the whole idea of not hearing of people actually renting stuff out. And to that, so far as I can tell, anecdotally speaking, it's similar to the Akia problem in general, in that, well, it's just not something that normal people do. So most people just don't do this sort of thing. Like the opportunity is there, but the kind of the precedent, I guess, for it is relatively conspicuously absent. There are, of course, people doing this, and Tracy, I'm sure you can chime in on this as well. But it's not like a standard thing to do. And especially through dealing with real estate in Japan, I find that usually people don't like doing non-standard things. And so that's just kind of why you see a lack.
I'll chime in with that. Yeah, that people don't like doing standard things. If there's no clear path of least resistance, then you do have to, you have a lot of hoops to jump through, and sometimes that sort of takes away, the immediate, profit and or fun when you've got to fight bureaucracy. And Minpaku licenses aren't that easy to come by as well. There's a lot of due diligence you've got to do before you can get one. And I think the other reason is that there's also a lot of vacancies, a lot of like normal vacancies. It's, it's not hard to, it's not hard to find places to rent. If you're just looking for a normal chintai, it's, normal rental for residency. It's not hard to find one. There's no shortage of houses. But
especially in the countryside, right?
Especially in the countryside, it's quite easy to find a place. But if somebody, that's an opportunity I see. It's not to say it can't be done. It's just that hasn't really been done publicly much. So maybe if someone goes and does it and then does a Netflix series on it, then it'll be the next thing to do, and it'll be the next craze, which is not necessarily a bad thing.
I dream of the day that happens.
Yeah, it would be good. I mean, I would do it myself. I just don't have the time and the funds. But if someone wants to go and do it, I think the market is wide open.
We're seeing increasing, and in fact, this is actually where the Japanese market kind of excels. With our international market, it's much more about, there's kind of a wellness element to it as well. But also frequently about just changing their residence or getting a second house, right? The Japanese market seems to be very interested in basically what amounts to kind of like Minpaku with a little bit of teleworking in there, but mm-hmm. operating in that universe. So we see it happening. Like it's happening in my backyard down in Yugawara. I know people who are doing this, and I see more people buying it up. But as with a lot of things in this kind of general territory, it's all rather fragmented and fractured, right? And so I don't think I'd call it, it's not a swell. I'd like to say that, but it's not yet, it's building, but it's, it's not yet a critical mass. But one thing that I also do, worry is maybe not the right word, but I think about anyway, is, well, even if we get a lot of people, like even more people doing this, if there's no sort of unified narrative or unified narratives about it, even if it gets big, it'll still remain a kind of underground, as it were.
Well, I mean, there's no set formula in any city office, right? So and that's the same with Minpaku. Like the way that licensing is handled is on a city by city, by region by region basis. Yeah. And that's the same with, I guess, with the Akia. It's like, there's no set formula. You've really got to, each one is a new learning curve. There's nothing that you can sort of do and then rinse and repeat. And that's when, when you, have a business model like that, that's when it's sort of more interesting to a developer.
Well, until someone starts, right? I mean, once,
like, until someone starts and and blogs about it and documents it, you know, someone who's not needing to make a quick turnaround, who's able to do it, lead the way.
Yeah. Matt, in your Akia Hunter video series, are you just, I've watched a few, but I've seen you looking at them and you know, inspecting them for purchase and so forth. You haven't actually done one where you're actually renovating a place, like a before after thing. Not yet, right?
No.
Is that in the works?
That's something that we're looking into. Honestly, we're a two-person team. We got a lot of stuff that we need to do. Editing videos, unfortunately, is not at the top of it. So I have all sorts of content that I'm intending to get out. But
so you have done these projects, you just haven't made a video of it yet?
There's one that kind of walks you through it, but no, we need, like, so far as actual, like, okay, this is the project and we're following it and all of that, we haven't done that yet. We do intend to get that out there. And I think, I mean, really, if you look at it's one of the major channels, like a lot of the most popular TV shows in Japan right now, what's the Potsun to Ikenya? Is that the one? There's a lot of interest in home renovation, especially rural home renovation right now. So to me, I mean, it's not even a hunch. Like, I can say pretty, like, it's odd that there seems to be probably something close to what you might call critical mass with regards to just interest in rural stuff. But there's it's that last mile thing. There's still something that's kind of getting in the way of really kind of turning the engine on and getting things rolling. I do think that the content, and that is something too that we very much aim to do with our business. Of course, you know, yeah, we help sell properties, but really kind of the crux of it though is to make cases and show precedents for not just daydreaming about living, you know, a more rural life, but actually saying, hey, look, here's a crazy guy.
It can be done,
It can be done.
Well, you know what? I come from a perspective where there's just not enough money in it for the time and effort required, which is why the people aren't picking it up, why we're not hearing about it, why it's not becoming a thing. Especially when you consider the time and effort required, there's the opportunity of that time and effort to be invested in, well, you have places like Tokyo, bigger cities.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so just off the bat, right? Like, and I want to ask, I guess, about actual numbers, right, that we're talking about. So what is the expected profitability, even if you get something for zero, right? Even if we start off with zero. So the best case scenario is you got a property for free, right? What are we looking at, like, to get it to the cost involved, or to get it to a
sellable condition?
Not sellable, or even just rentable. If you're renting for, and let's not talk about Minpaku, right? There's this thing, someone wants to we sell all regular Japanese rental.
The second part of his question is actually about that. He's asking, in terms of this repair of these properties, what are the typical jobs involved? Is it a quick paint job here and there, or some gutters, or, you know, deeper issues like framing and rot and mold, and like, are we talking 10,000, 100,000? I suppose there's not really a benchmark for that, right?
It all depends on what you're looking for, yeah. Right? But I mean, if you want to spend an additional 200,000 US on renovating, we can totally find you one of those. I don't know why you'd want to do it, but that's possible. There are also other ones that require, you know, maybe on the order of 100,000 yen or hundreds of thousands of yen, not dollars. So we're talking. Yeah.
So, yeah. So, like, my thing is, okay. So let's, because this comes up a lot, right? Why? What about this flip? And I've explained in the past, like, why flipping doesn't even make sense for Tokyo properties. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense for individuals. There are companies that do it professionally. They have access to the finance. That's their business. And you look at their database. They don't have one or two a month. They'll have like 20 or 30. Available listings at any one time.
Yeah.
That they are flipping, right? So it's a big business. So the idea of flipping works. But we talked about it, and I guess I'll repeat some of the numbers and stuff that as we go through. So we mentioned capital gains tax. So for people listening, if you sell real estate for a profit, and you've held it for less than 5 years, it's 40% of the profit is capital gains tax, is taxable, right? You have to hold it for over 5 years for it to be the lower rate of 20% capital gains tax. I think that those are the right numbers, correct?
Yep.
Yeah. There's 40% for the first, with if you sell within the first 5 years, 20% if you sell it after that. Okay. So that's one reason why it doesn't work for an individual. Again, if your business is a real estate renovation company, then you don't pay that capital gains tax.
Rather, and you probably get the contacts in place to actually make it profitable, yeah. Right?
Yeah, right.
And
yeah.
Mostly they're mostly apartments, though, as well. They're buying up sort of the condo style, like, you know, mansion.
I've seen houses.
No, they do houses. Yeah, we bought ours from a company that did exactly that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, they do houses as well. And what happens is those ones never even come to the market. Okay, whoever wants to sell is like, you know, we want to sell it quickly without any of the typical like 3 month wait period, or they don't have the capacity to do that. And the agent will say, look, if you want to sell it, let's say it's worth 50 million. Look, if you're going to want to, all right, selling it for 40 million yen or 42 million yen, like at a almost 20% discount or so, then yeah, okay, I have a company, a renovation company, they'll buy it cheaply and they'll fix it up. And sometimes it can be very minor, just new wallpaper. And maybe, you know, some cleaning, right? New stovetop, and that's it. So they haven't actually changed the bathroom, toilets, or kitchen. They just cleaned it up, and wallpaper is like the bare minimum. But that's still considered a renovation flip, right? They'll say, yeah, I got this company, it'll come. And those coming, yeah, great, cool, let's sign the contract, we get it done. We've got the financing approved because they've already got lines of credit. They don't need to do the typical application and stuff that we do. That individuals need to do, and they're able to access it really cheap because they know it never goes to market, and it's very, very convenient for the seller. Whereas as an individual, you don't have that ability to buy it at that cheaper price. And just talking about the scale of numbers, right? You can get, if you buy cheap enough, it's okay to get 5 to 10 million yen off a property in Tokyo, right? That's 50 million yen or an old apartment. Right, or let alone even if it's a, you know, a more expensive one, even 15 million yen off. So just by purchasing wisely, you save 15 million yen, right? That you can sort of make on top in terms of the flip. Whereas what numbers are we looking at for these, like the Akiya, right? The whole project, including purchase, full renovation, etc., might be 10 million yen, right? And if you do flip, like how much, what's the expected, you know, whoever's flipping, what are they expecting to make? They're going to buy it for, or get it, let's say for nothing, right? Spend 5 to 8 million yen on renovating it. Like, I mean, if they bought it for nothing, it might cost almost 100 grand.
And then you sell it for up to that 12 maybe if you're lucky, right?
What are they making? Like five million, like maybe what? They're talking a good case is maybe making 5 million yen. I've got no idea, but there's like, if you can make 5 million yen on a flip, do you think that's that like for an Akiya type property? Does that seem like it's way undervalued? Like, is that a very low estimate or is that a realistic or high estimate?
Depends on how much time you spent on it too, right? How much time and effort it took you.
It's extremely variable. It wouldn't really make any sense. Like, I'm sure you could probably pull, if it was in the right place and the right build and not very dilapidated and this, that, if all the pieces came together, yeah, maybe, but just because the entire landscape is just so out of whack and poorly administered, like it's very, very difficult to even make estimates like that, which is why one of the major reasons why we don't really dabble in investment properties. We are, or at least try to be pretty, open.
Lifestyle oriented.
Exactly, yeah. Right? Because the fact is, this is kind of no man's land that we're dealing with right now. If sort of like Tracy was saying, you know, if somebody who had patience and the funds and was willing to take the risk and go in there and do it a few times and just make that case, that would be very, very, very positive in that it would finally kind of, well, hopefully anyway, break down sort of the stigmas that are associated with both Akiya as well as Inaka. But the fact is right now, that hasn't happened yet, right? And so really we need to encourage, before we could even honestly start talking about sort of returns and ROI and whatnot, the environment right now isn't even tooled like for that use case. And so the first thing that we're really trying to do right now is merely affect people that kind of appeal to the emotional side of things and be like, well, yeah, okay, you're probably not going to make a profit on it, but you got a great vacation house, you're in the forest, there's the wellness thing, you got the trees and the monkeys and whatnot. That's really kind of our appeal at the moment. So far as the
his idea of leasing them out to foreign farm workers in those areas, I mean, like Tracy was saying, it's very easy to find places to rent that are not.
There's not a lot of demand. Like, you know, it's not as if there's a massive housing shortage, and there's no inbound workers right now. So there's not a massive shortage. I mean, if that changes, obviously, then there'll be more incentive to do that, because that you could get more more ROI. But a lot of the Accia is the purchase and renovation is more labors of love. It's for lifestyle. Yeah. and also like I rescued a house from destruction, and there's a beauty to that. So yeah. If it's pure hard numbers, if it's pure investment, there's not masses amount of meat in there.
And there's not a blueprint to follow yet as well. Okay, so for the last part of his question, and I guess I know the answer to this one, but I'll just check in any case. Are there any legal requirements for a house to be at minimum levels of, you know, either renovation or safety before you can? Well, he's asking about selling or renting it out. I know for a fact, and Matt can probably testify, that there's no requirement for a sale. Like, people buy basically two blocks of cardboard and a bit of wood and call it a house. But how about for renting it to a tenant?
For Minpaku, I can answer that. For Minpaku, you need to get your license. You actually have to have a safety certificate, which means that a certified company has to come in and, you know, you have to jump through all of their hoops and make sure it's mostly fire regulations that you've got to check. Yeah. But you won't be able to rent it out for short-term rental if you don't have this safety certificate.
Yeah, but that's just fire stuff. But just that. That's regular fire stuff. So that can be, there's basically fire alarm systems, right? For the most
there's
part,
a bit like more light, than that, lighting. Though, isn't there?
Lighting, but it's not really structural. They're not checking the structural integrity of the property.
Yeah.
Right. So you can get like basically an electrician to come in, electrical company come in, and they need to put the necessary emergency lighting in place and fire alarms in place.
So it's not a fire hazard.
Yeah. So, if there is a fire, people can exit. Like, people, the exit signs are labeled and what have you, right? So, but that's not fire safety checks. It's not something. It's not a structural renovation. So, even if the pillars are rotting, you can still get the. That's not going to be covered by the fire check, right? Whereas, if you want to rent it out for regular Japanese rental, and I think this is one thing I wanted to mention before. When you're doing a regular chintai, Japanese style rental, you're going to have difficulty renting it out if it's not really up to scratch.
Yeah.
Okay. Especially when you're comparing it to like place like mansions that are just designed straight up for rental, and it's a concrete building without any of the structural issues. Maintenance is sort of kept up. Whereas like if you have an issue with your akiya, right? If the windows are, if water is leaking.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If the windows aren't opening and closing properly, you need to, like, the tenant can complain, say like these things need to be functioning. If the door's not locked, they don't just put up with it. If the bathtub, they have one of those old whatever bathtubs like that, and if that's leaking, you have to repair it. They're not like, oh, it's old, so they like the charm of it being a mess. No, for rentals, it's very, very tough. It's got to meet the standards of a typical rental.
But so I suppose that somebody who would be renting an Akiya is not exactly the same tenant profile that you would be renting a mansion in the city, right?
Yeah, so it's not as... Yeah, so the problem is that means the market is a lot lower. It's a lot less. It's not... So it doesn't... It's not a comparable, let's just rent it out. Let's get this option. Let's see if this property for almost nothing and make it a rental. And now I've got a whole portfolio of these great rental properties that cost me nothing.
Who's going to rent them?
Yeah, exactly. Who's going to rent them? They're not great rental portfolio. It's not a great rental portfolio. Whereas if you just had, you know, a portfolio of 10 different apartments in mansions, even one room mansions, you're laughing, right? Assuming that they're just an ordinary mansion that we're familiar with in a concrete building, you pay the management fee and stuff, and that's it. That's really easy.
But that said, so there is a lot of vacancy as well. Like, you know, there is, if you're looking for an apartment to rent, to live in, you know, there's a lot of vacancies. So, you know, there's not masses of demand that's pushing the prices up. If anything, they're, you know, they've been really flat for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, we haven't been able to raise the rents on long-term leases, which is most of what we do. It's very rare that we can raise the rent between tenants. In most cases, it's either the same, and often it's actually less. So, yeah.
Mm.
When there's a new development being built in the area, but again, this is nothing to do with Inaka, but if there's a new building that was just recently constructed, it kind of goes in waves. Like if an area becomes popular, then there's going to be construction going up. And once construction goes up, then, you know, all of these new beautiful apartments are available for rent at prices that are, you know, they're definitely higher, but they're not like double the price of the old ones. So then that creates huge pressure on older building owners. And it's kind of a race to the bottom with the rents. Like you have to keep reducing it. The alternative to that is to offer all sorts of incentives. If you don't want to join the race, you offer incentives that might attract tenants, like, you know, first month or two free rent, or, you know, the owner will pay the move-in fees, or in some cases, depending on location, maybe furnished or semi-furnished and that kind of thing. And then you might be able to hold the rent, but you're definitely not going to be raising it.
Yeah, raising rent, like in typical in Tokyo, is a very, very uncommon and hard thing to do. And it's also kind of equivalent to asking we had a situation recently saying, can we do it? And our rental team was saying, basically, if you want to increase the rent, the tenant can say no. And if you want to, then you go to the, you know, basically to the court, and you can say, look, the reason we're increasing this is because market prices, look at the assessed land tax, market prices have gone up 20%.
Yeah.
Okay. So it makes sense that it goes up. And the tenant can, like you say, well, if you're going to raise it, then I'm going to leave.
We interrupt this broadcast. I always wanted to say this. We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, or if you just need summer quiet to hide away from the world. So they offer a variety of options for families, for corporate relocations, or simply if you're transitioning between homes in Tokyo. Now, the properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really, the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They've got fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens, and they're just a delight to stay in, a fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but long-term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profits, or a holiday home that you want rented out when not in use via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth your visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at emil.gorgies, G-O-R-G-E-E-S, at tokyorealty.jp.
Which is what happened to us. They didn't even get to court. As soon as we told them we're raising the rent, they didn't even say no. They just left.
Yeah, like exactly. So there's one.
Then you
got to
be sure that you're going to be getting that rent from the next one, right? Because otherwise you're stuck.
Yeah, but if there's no increase, like if you get the land tax assessment, and there's, you know, I'm not seeing like a 20% increase in the government's land tax assessment, you're going to be hard pressed to legally sort of increase the rent.
we don't even go by that. I mean, we have had properties that have increased in value. That has been a thing in some areas. It's happened in Tokyo, it's happened in Fukuoka and a lot of cities that we deal with. But rents haven't gone up. I mean, and that's not going to happen unless salaries go up, and salaries haven't gone up for a long, long while. If people can't afford to, and, you know, there are other comparable properties in the vicinity for a similar rent, then why, you know, they will just move out and move into one of those, right? And they don't like to move if they don't have to, and they'll never approach you to ask you to reduce the rent if it's gone down. Like, we've got tenants in place that have been paying, you know, pre-bubble rent, which is almost double to what it is these days. They'll never ask us for a discount, but, you know, on the same token, we can't raise the rent on that. Okay, well, that's it for what I thought was a big and juicy question. Thank you for that.
Yeah. My take on the flipping side is, if you start a business flipping, like, you know, when I say smaller value properties, you go to the effort of finding them. Renovation work is actually a lot more complex, I think, would be for an older IKEA type house than an old mansion. It's like than a Tokyo based apartment or mansion. Just say you start doing an IKEA and you've done four or five of them and you're making a few million yen off each property. You're like, hold on. Then you see an opportunity in Tokyo for a place that's, instead of being a four bedroom house, a huge house that's worth 10 million yen, it's a 15 square meter one room apartment for the same price. It's like, hey, I can get this re-wallpapered and ready to flip in about a week.
Yeah.
Okay.
No structural work.
Yeah, it's like hold on. I just feel like, you know, it's faster to do. The turnover is faster. So, and the more turnover means the more properties that you can do. And because it's more standard, it's easier to guess the market price. What you're going to be able to resell it for or rent it for. So you know if it's worth doing the purchase on it. And it's very easy to understand structurally. There are not going to be any surprises that the beams are running. Usually it's going to be a concrete apartment and you see all the renovation history, right? So you're not responsible for a lot of the structural side of stuff, or you have some guarantee that it's okay. I just see, like, if you are successful in doing the IKEA type flips and renovations, you're just going to, like, it just seems like easier. I don't know. If you're coming from the purely financial profit-based aspect, which I think that question almost is, right? If it's a labor of love and
you want to... Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's kind of like the guest house story, right? Like, if that's your thing and you're the DIY type and it's a labor of love and you're really loving to you know, bring these, you know, older gorgeous homes back to their glory and then sell it at some sort of profit, then yeah. But if you're looking to make a profit, there are easier ways to do it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, financing is also going to be a lot easier.
Financing is non-existent for IKEA, right?
Basically, if you're under 10 mil, nobody's going to talk to you. If you're over 10 mil, somebody might, but it's still...
They got to think it's worth 10 mil, right?
Yeah, it's doable, but it's not all that common. Usually you can either do that or get renovation loans, but mostly our clientele is just basically paying all through cash.
Yeah.
And I think the cash buys for that, it means it's hard to scale. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have 15 million yen for each project. Well, let's say 10 million yen a project, $100,000 per project, which is even put that, right? Because it's going to be between like 8 and 12. Right. Or 5 and 15, right? So 10 million a project, like, how many are you going to be doing, right?
That ties into what you were explaining, Emil, about how loans work here. It's not actually drawing on the equity. There's always going to be a limit based on whatever you're making, right?
Yeah. And especially, and if it's only, if I think IKEA is going to be, it's 100% cash.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you're going to have, I think, just access to, you're going to be able to access things more, access funds more, if you're doing it with apartments that you can get financing for, even if it's an investment loan, right? The model is pretty straightforward. Okay, you buy it, this is how much they're worth, and you're like, this is how much rent you can expect, this is how much renovations cost, etc. That's something easier to present to a bank. However, sorry, Tracy, you want to?
I was going to say, it's the other thing that's you know, we're talking just pure real estate, whereas what, you know, where I see big opportunities is where someone is doing a hybrid with an existing sort of peripheral business. So for example, yeah. I know some people who are, you know, using finance to renovate and actually build a CrossFit gym in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. Yeah. And actually building a business or an infrastructure and an ecosystem that's not just based on the bricks and the mortar, well, the timber and the
plaster.
Yeah, but built around another type of business, whether it be, like I said, a CrossFit gym or some sort of experience or a yoga retreat, Matt.
Working on it. Working on it. I've already got the teach. I've already got the yogi.
Wellness spa. You know, with that, when you actually build as a destination, a different business, and then you use Akia, like, you know, use the renovation of the areas around you, that's certainly a really good way of reducing costs.
And so that's a really good point that you make, Tracy, is that kind of the thing that really kind of triggered my interest in all of this, as many things, it goes back to music, but it's very similar to CrossFit or whatever, in that Akia by themselves are probably a pretty lackluster and uninteresting thing. However,
the application,
as Tracy very astutely pointed out, if you consider them in relation to each other and an ecosystem, what they really represent or can represent is nascent infrastructure, right? And with that, then you can start building communities or destinations or experiences or this, that, and the other thing. And so they're really not intended to even really be investment properties, even in the best of times. And that's not the purpose that they're serving. The purpose that they're serving is facilitating people doing people stuff, right? And presumably, you know, paying for a weekend yoga retreat, which you can charge up to about $800 a pop for if you want.
Exactly. Yes.
Right.
And make the cash on that. Or
wellness retreats out in Yamanashi that we're working on. There's some stuff out in Chiba as well. There's a whole bunch of surf culture down in the Izu Peninsula, as well as diving. And in fact, Manazuru, the spot that's one stop up north of where I live in Yugawara, is an incredibly popular and very robust Akia ecosystem. And people are investing there, right, for dive retreats and snorkel retreat and fishing and stuff like this. And so from a strictly financial tool point of view, Akia are a terrible fucking idea.
And this goes back to what we were talking about last week, Tracy, with them. If there is a community and an infrastructure similar to the Airbnb and Minpaku discussion, right, if there is a community of not landlords, but owners who are getting into this and marketing their area and communicating with each other and sharing their resources to make it an experience, to put the place on the map, so to speak, then there's a lot that you can do. But as long as everybody stays in their bubble and this is just like my dream home, maybe yes, maybe no, it's not going to happen, is it?
No, and I really think that, you know, it's more than just like house. It's just more than house by house by house. It's like, if you look at it as a project basis, there's a lot to be done. But you know, some of these small country towns are just not that pretty. They're just not. But
that can be solved, though.
You can make it. That can be solved if you think out of the box and like think, well, what can I do to make this a destination of its own? So whether it be the yoga or the CrossFit or the whatever it is
the goats,
or there's all sorts of stuff you could do, like, you know, there's ecotourism, there's adventure tourism, there's like all sorts of stuff.
So interestingly,
weddings, pop-up weddings, or
a wedding village, that almost sounds like Nightmare Before Christmas kind of stuff.
No.
Interestingly, I was just up in Ishikawa, I think I mentioned that previously. And there's a city there called Wajima. It's on the north coast facing the Sea of Japan. I just sent a link over. There's a spot called, I don't even know what to call it, right? Because it has a name. It's called Kabule. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. But what it is, I think it's a government initiative that bought up a whole bunch of Akia, got some pretty decent architects from Kanazawa, which is a well-known kind of historical landmark city, also in Ishikawa Prefecture, and renovated them and turned them into Akia cafes and Akia ramen shops and Akia libraries and kind of all of this stuff, right? And it was also extremely interesting that a lot of the employees, one of the reasons that they did this, I guess, was to facilitate, I want to say prefectural people in Ishikawa Prefecture who might have, you know, a mental or a physical disability that makes it difficult for them to work. And so a lot of the employees, like salaried employees at these places that were produced using Akiya, ended up supporting these communities as well. It's very rural. It's very hard to get to. I was actually very, very surprised that this existed. But when I was in Ishikawa, I mentioned to the ryokan owner, like, oh, no, Akiya and stuff. They were like, dude, you got to go check out Wajima. It's an amazing thing that they've done. Down.
That's exactly it, though. Like, they created a destination. That's what we keep telling people who are looking into these old resorts, and some of them are in really good shape and some of them are huge and some of them are really cheap, like, you know, 20-30 room former onsen hotel resort that you can buy for like less than half a mil. It's a really good deal, but it's not going to be enough to create the perfect resort. You're not going to have to create the whole destination to get people to come there.
Exactly. You've literally got to like build a world.
I'm also thinking if it's a location where there are so many Akiya, they're just like, it's maybe not a very attractive location. That's why it was able to get so many Akiya there.
But that could be just because it hasn't been attractive in the sense that, you know, nobody's actually set up shop there to make it attractive. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's something wrong with it.
But when
certainly the case.
But when it's artificial, like when the government tries to artificially just like, you know, they build it and they will come. I think the places that become, you know, gentrified there's a natural kind of like an evolutionary process to it. It's not, it doesn't matter how much money you throw at it.
Yes.
Superficially, if the infrastructure isn't there, if there isn't something a bit more compelling to be there, you know, and you look at like some snow resorts, well, like they have the fact that there's snow, right? There's a certain thing about it, right? You can't just make something out of nothing, right?
Well,
like,
I mean,
to a degree, yes.
But Japan, how ugly can it be?
Yeah,
it can get pretty ugly.
Yeah, but I mean that we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago is that artist island, you know, that sprung up but that was a decision by the town to make it an artist retreat.
How many of them are going to be so successful? Yeah, like, how many of those are actually successful?
Very, very often the municipal government is the municipality's worst enemy. They tend to just be terrible at everything.
It's not a joke. That's really the case, though, unfortunately. So,
but that's also why, I mean, another part, we're still kind of spinning it up, but what we dubbed the Inaka Club, right, is just getting people out there for kind of unique, I like the word visceral, but like unique, kind of intimate, not in like the sexual sense, but, you know, just like people getting together and like having an experience together. And just being able to open and kind of guide people, hold their hands into having, honestly, probably not even that like spectacular of an experience, merely an experience in a place that they never thought that they could have that before, right? That's very important. And if you don't do that, right, as Emil was pointing out, you can't make something out of nothing.
That's the first step, though. People have to fall in love with something, right?
Exactly. Yeah, well, so really, there's a whole lot of serendipity involved in it, because not all the places are great. Like, I'll be the first person to tell you that. There's a lot of places that I think are just like, please, we should be wiped off the map.
That area where you said they made like Chinakias, and they got like, you know, a lot of the disabled community to you know, get employed there. How hot are the cafes? You want to go and get a coffee, right? And how awesome are these coffee shops or these restaurants that they got there?
They're not spectacular.
Can you find a better one down in Shimokitazawa? Right? Like, or even just any location. One that's like, one where it really has an individual who's like, I'm going to start a coffee shop and I'm going to go and set up, like, this is a nice area. It's a bit of a spot. I'm going to go and make a cafe there, like, you know, or the artsy type of gallery, a gallery / cafe thing. Someone who's actually gone there with that intent versus, and the quality of that cafe, and you go there and you can, you know, have a good experience. And when one hot cafe sort of opens up in a good spot, that leads to maybe more sort of artists or more sort of people coming through. It's the art culture.
It's sort of a labor of love. It's sort of saying, hey, I recognize this place actually isn't all that great, but like, let's go do it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, but right? Yeah, but it's gonna have something for it, right? You know, whereas that's why if it's just the municipalities, like, oh, you know what, let's just see if it sticks.
Well, that could either be the spot, though, or it could be the community itself. If the community is unique enough and brings something to the table that's, you know, that's difficult to find in other places, then, you know, the natural settings might matter a little bit less.
I was blown away by the accessibility of this Wajima place, which is something that I'm quite keen about. Long story, but yeah.
So it's very accessible, you mean?
Extremely accessible. Easily too. Right.
But that puts it on the map for you know, people who are looking for very accessible places. I mean, and there's a whole marketing around, you know, traveling in Japan, like
weekend getaway kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And serving a particular niche. And what I was going to jump in with was that, you know, if you do have an idea of building a business, there's a bunch of like rural revitalization grant money that you can get. Yes, it's a real pain to fill out all the forms, but there's money there. And then you can match the the METI, the METI grants that you can get. I can actually send you the link for the METI grants if you want to put them in the show notes, Siv.
Yeah.
And you know, that's free money. You have to put the money in first and then they will reimburse you up to 50% of what you've invested.
Yeah, it's happening here in Saga now. I know quite a few people who've been getting into it.
And then you can play the local banks. There's money that's been allocated to these various places. And if you can put a good enough case study forward, and you know, you've got to do, you know, fill out the forms, and you've got to have your business plan like you should as a proper business anyway. But if you can, you know, go through that red tape, there's money to be had.
You still need to know. You still need to know how to make a business and how to make it profitable.
Absolutely. Like, you still have to have Saga a project, viable idea, friend. You know, whether it's been tested or not, doesn't, yeah. You know, this is a way that you can test it using government money rather than your own. But
not, like you said, it's 50%, right? So like here in Saga,
that's
my friend.
Significant.
Sorry?
That's significant though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it is significant. But I mean, 50% of $1 million is still $500,000. If you're going to make it you're going to put in $500,000 and nobody comes, you're still going to be out of pocket, right?
Yeah, no, but I know someone who's done that. And actually what she's done is leveraged then the local banks to fund the money up front as a bank loan. So the grant money comes after she spent the money, because she's got the grant money secured, she's able then to leverage that and get a bank loan to cover the upfront costs so that she's not up for it personally. And then a lot of the bank loan is then paid off by the grant money that comes in after she spent the money. So if you're creative with, you know, if you're creative with your finance, or you work with a business partner who's creative with that, there are ways to do this. You've got to have a really, you know, solid idea first.
My next thing is, how do you do this with young kids? So, and by that, I mean, if you like,
it's a lifestyle, Emil, and it's not art.
Exactly. It's a lifestyle. It's just, I think all the time, like, people that have almost the like, you have to be so individually involved and basically relocate, because you're not traveling there just every morning, right? You're going to need to relocate, I think, for a big part of it. So, if you have a family, or if you have other regular employment, like this is, you can't do this as just a side hustle.
Could. It depends on where you are, right?
Like, and how old the kids are.
I would, the family things are complicated.
Speaking of kids, hey, Tracy.
Hello, this is my... look, I can run a, like, I run a business with a kid, you know.
Hello.
This camera's funny.
It's funny, yeah. It's
following you.
There we go. So anyway, I didn't want to interrupt your thought process, Emil, of being able to work with kids. I mean, it's hard. It's a juggle, and
It's more the location, right? We're talking rural, like basically whether you like, if you like the country or not, your kids are going to be at local schools. And then you have to go to, unless you're doing the revitalization project locally and you don't have to really move, then that's okay. But when you go to another prefecture, you're gone. I think that's where the issues are around. Like, you know, there's people like that have their own businesses. Like, you know, Trey's example, like you can have kids and have your own business. But the business that we're talking about now, about revitalizing areas and finding good deals and regrowing them up and making them cool and funky, that's not 2 kilometers down the road.
That comes up every once in a while. The Fujino area of Kanagawa is kind of our go-to sort of recommendation. The educational facilities there are, what is it, the Steiner School? Right. It's a straight shot on the Chuo line. So like it's accessible. It's about an hour, I think, west-ish, northwest of, let's say, Shinjuku. We know some people there fixing up Akiya and stuff. But I mean, you're correct, right? This is also not something that is for everybody. Like it's all a very circumstantial kind of thing. And
again, labor of love. It's not an investment strategy. It's a project.
We were talking about financing a second ago, right? And the difficulty will be for financing a property in like Akiya, right? It's basically, it's all cash job. I want to touch on that. We have a client right now who's looking just by Kamagawa River. Mm. He's looking at buying a property. And what's happened is it's a two-story property. But it has a large, like the second floor has like a large, quite a high ceiling. And so what you have is a loft. Okay, it's pretty common, and by regulation a loft is like sort of an attic space.
Okay, yeah,
but it can't be more than 1.4 meters high though, so they have to cap the ceiling, right? So I've got one sort of in my place as well. I've got two lofts, and you go in and even though it looks like the roof line can go higher, there is a ceiling at 1.4 meters and it's often like, you know, so if the roof is like this, there'll be a ceiling line at 1.4 meters. And then there's the slope on the sides, right? So, and even if you think, wow, they can just open this up and make it really quite high, by regulation, if it's over 1.4 meters, it'll be counted as a room and counted as space.
Mm.
Okay. So let's say the property can be a maximum of 100 square meters and you have a loft area. The loft area, if the ceiling is 1.4 meters high, it's even if it's like 10 square meters or 15 square meters, it won't add to the 100 square meters of the building.
Right.
The regulation says this building can't be more than 100 square meters. The loft space area doesn't count.
This is relevant for what? For property tax calculations?
No, but just for building regulations. Yeah. Right? Yeah. But the situation we had is once it was built, the cell, it's a 10-jaw loft, which is quite a large size.
Massive, yeah.
Yeah, it's above the living room, and it had like just an old ladder. Once they bought it, got the financing, they built in like a fixed staircase, and they removed that ceiling and put it all, like the flat 1.4 meter high ceiling, and put it all the way to the roof, which is about 2 meters high, 2.2 meters. And it slants down, but it's pretty much, but you can use it as even a bedroom. Like it's not, like even the slant is not low, it's massively high. So they have like this oven, now it's like a 10-jaw extra size third floor. And we went to the bank looking for a bank loan, and the banks won't touch it. Mm-hmm. Banks will not touch it. They say, and there's also a balcony that like they built like where their driveway is. They extended the balcony out. So now the balcony is like about 2.5 or 3 meters deep and by 4 meters wide. It's a nice, beautiful balcony. And it's by the water on mm-hmm. Tamagawa River. So basically, straight up the balcony, like it's just the river right in front of you.
It won't touch it because what? Because you conceivably built over your ratio?
Yeah. So now it's gone from a two-story building to a three-story building. So the land title says it's a two-story building, but now it's got a third story. Even though you haven't added extra just by removing that, now that ceiling is too high, right? So it's considered a third story. And the balcony, the deck, how they calculate, I think we've discussed before, is what gets classified as building, like in the building footprint, is a roof covered area.
Right.
So the fact that you have a deck, even if it's uncovered, it doesn't add to the space, but the area below it, the old open car park that used to be below it is now has a roof on top of it that you can use to store stuff under, and it rain cannot go through. That's now a roof for the space below.
Oh.
So it goes over in terms of footprint. So the building footprint is now much too large. And also the area as well is counted. So that first floor that used to be 50 square meters is now 65 square meters. Even though it's still a car park area, it's now covered.
Mm-hmm.
The only way to get around that, for at least, well, I don't know about the car park, but I know people who've actually got a builder in and put a wall on, like taking the staircase, like hidden the staircase behind a wall, and had the bank inspection, got the bank finance, and then re-renovated it after they moved in.
So that's part of the discussion now is, okay, well, let's fill it up. Drywall and see what you can do about you removing the adjusting the balcony. But the problem is the balcony is a big like steel frame that's in the concrete.
It's a balcony steel breaker.
So even if we just remove the floorboards from it, reduce the width of it, and make it just like 30 centimeter deep balcony, and remove the deck flooring. So now you go in the carport, and although there's the driveway, although there's a metal balcony frame around you,
it's open.
There's no ceiling above it, right? There's no roof. The bank, once they see it and they've seen the floor plans, like they'll go and go, well, we know what you're gonna do. Like we know, like this is gonna be extended.
How stupid do you think we are?
Yeah, it seems like so that's kind of the challenge. So we talk about how difficult it is to get financing for even an Akia, even a house, and this house is like 16 years old. Just because of these two minor sort of changes, which it's nothing actually structural. That roof, they haven't made the roof higher, like the actual exterior roof. All they've moved is the ceiling, like the fake ceiling, and made it like, you know, going up with the actual height of the roof, the natural roof.
That disqualifies
it. That disqualifies it. And now they've got like just a steel deck out front, like a carport equivalent. That's disqualified it. Financing is very difficult. So it has to be priced a lot cheaper, and it's likely going to be a cash buyer. We're talking probably like in the mid 50 million yen range. In Tokyo. So yeah, just about that. So that's called like how we refer to that when we're typically is a kempeibitsu is the name for the footprint, building footprint, as a percentage of the land size, and yosekibitsu is the total land, total floor space of the property, right? Like first floor, second floor, and third floor combined as a portion to the land size. So it'd be like this particular area is 40% and 80%, 40% footprint, 80% property size ratio. In more dense areas, like where I live in Setagaya, it's 60% and 150% is the footprint.
If they had cash, they could just buy it, right? There would be no impediment to purchase.
Yeah, precisely, yeah. So it's purely with the financing.
The finance,
if they're
going
to buy cash. What makes buying a property in Tokyo, your own family home, such a good, like so attractive, is that the money is free, essentially. If the bank will give you 100% or 105% financing, and the interest is like 0.5%, 0.7%. Okay, the one guy we got, I think at the start of this year, was 0.475%. And recently, one of our staff got, like one of our sales staff, got for a Japanese guy, 0.425% for 100% loan. And that's the interest rate. So it's free money. So why would you put $500,000 of your own cash when you can get, you know, 3 to 7% just, you know, or more just in even, you know, bonds or stock market, etc., or any kind of other asset class.
Emil, one question I totally forgot to ask you. Actually, after that, I might have to log off, but you guys can carry on.
Yeah, I gotta go.
With mortgages, so you know how you mentioned time and time again that you guys also act as mortgage brokers, right?
Yes.
And you obviously serve foreign customers, so for you, it's kind of a routine thing. When we have customers who are looking to purchase in other cities that are not that familiar with foreigners, there's still the same infrastructure in place in the sense that the listing agent, especially if it's a bigger agency, usually have bank connections and can help organize a mortgage. Yeah. But how easy is it for them in, say, Kumamoto to approach their bank and say they've got a foreign buyer, which they probably haven't done much before?
Well, so when you say approach their bank, it will be, you know, generally the big ones are MUFG, Mizuho, and SMBC.
Yeah.
They're the mega banks. Rizona is also one of the big ones now. Okay, so, and Rizona Bank. So they're the big four banks. And then there's the local banks. So usually they'll approach just one of the big ones. Okay.
So that's what most agents do, is it?
They go most with agents, even in other prefectures, right? They'll have the loan officers assigned to their agency, like what we do. So our agency here in Tokyo, in Ibise, we have loan officers assigned from the mortgage center. They are assigned to our agency, to our account. So, you know, if you want, like if I have a client and I think, okay, SMBC will give them the best deal, I will just call, like email or fax some documentation to our bank, to our loan, the loan center in Shibuya, where our loan officer is assigned. And then I'll give him a call. I was like, okay, Tanaka-san, I just emailed you some documentation. This is a client, this is a situation. Usually, like I'll say that, like if they're just a salaried employee, this typical salary man, then I don't even need to do that. I have a good idea of how much the bank will loan him or her. Well, generally it's like someone, oh, maybe they've just changed jobs. I say, this is what they were doing. And now they've just changed jobs 2 months ago. Here are their last two pay slips. What should we do? Like, how long do we need to wait until they've been employed at their current job until they do it, et cetera. So usually if it's really squeaky clean, like, you know, they've been salaried employee of the same company for, you know, for 3 years, 4 years, and they have permanent residency, then it's quite straightforward. Once they are no longer that, they have any other kind of issue, they're self-employed, a business owner, they don't have permanent residency, we need to start. It gets to be a bit more difficult. But in general, if they're permanent residents out in the middle of nowhere, but outside of Tokyo, sorry, let me rephrase that, then yeah, the agent should be able to engage with the banks. Otherwise,
assuming it's one of the big ones, if it's a small local bank,
well, even a small local agency will know which banks to deal with. Okay, and if they have no one, sometimes the local agents, it's a mom and pop shop. They may not have anyone they deal with, and they just have the exclusive right of the listing. They, you know, if you really want that property, then yeah, you can just walk into any branch on your own and say you want to buy it. But you need to have permanent residency.
If not,
then you can ask the agent, look, which bank will finance this? And they may say the local Shinyo Ginko, the local trust bank or local credit union in that area will be able to do it. And in that case, then you go speak to that branch as an individual.
Right. So then the buyer needs to walk in and try to get the loan. But then again, if we're running into local smaller banks that might not be used to dealing with foreigners on a regular basis.
But dealing with foreigners is, do you have permanent residency or not? That's the idea of dealing with foreigners.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the hurdle.
You have a stable salary and are you a resident? That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you have permanent residency, then. Yeah. All right.
See you next time.
Take it easy.
All right.
I think.
Awesome. So that answers all of my questions. I'm good to call it a day. Thank you.
I'm good to call it a day too. Yeah, I've got a question for Emil in a bit, so we'll just hang on.
Awesome.
All right.
Thanks, folks.
See you. Bye, Ziv.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Recording. Stop.
So there you have it. Nice long conversation there, information packed as usual, and I hope a touch of reality for many of you out there who, like our listener who sent in the questions, may have some ideas that are very applicable in many other countries, but not always here in Japan. Things can be a bit different here, and it's important to be aware of these differences before pulling the trigger on any expenses. Hope you found value in the conversation. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa
and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.